Chapter 4 Detroit's Military Entrance Processing Station was a windowless barn of a building, set 20 miles from the city in a no-man's land of wide boulevards and acres of parking lot. Inside, Jim joined the crowd of young people from throughout the state. The latest group of enlistees arrived for a day of endless paperwork, interviews, and physical exams, their voices echoing from cinder block walls and the high ceiling. Lines formed and reformed as recruits were directed from desk to cubicle to private office. Jim thought of the mazes he'd worked in the Highlights magazine in the dentist's waiting room back home, the puzzles he'd never quite solved before the hygienist would call his name. He moved from station to station, completed a questionnaire here, spoke with a uniformed counselor there, tallied childhood mumps and measles and chicken pox at the medical technician's table, all the while imagining some logic to the chaos. Failing to discover a method to the bureaucratic madness, he resigned himself to following barked orders. Move to the background screening interview, report for the eye and ear exam, stand in this line until it is divided and rearranged, wait here. The results of his ASVAB test indicated that Jim was highly intelligent and would adapt easily to military life. His impressive scores had qualified him to select the military occupational specialty he wished to choose, that of infantryman or electrician or military policeman, and he'd set his heart on MOS 82 Bravo. As a map maker, he'd merge his interests and his abilities and create surveys and charts, channeling his talents with pen and ink as he so loved to do. An understanding of spatial concepts had always come easily, and his grades in Mr. Ingram's drafting class were all the resume he'd need. The MOS coordinator glanced at Jim's transcript, then at his spreadsheet of available positions. He frowned, then brightened. Plenty of enlistees had already been assigned as 82Bs, he informed Jim, but a related MOS, 82 Charlie, was wide open. He turned then to Jim's paperwork, clicked his ballpoint once or twice, and entered Jim's assignment on the blank line, Artillery Surveyor. Jim gleaned from the coordinator's brief explanation that surveying had something to do with using the sun and stars and nearby trees to determine positions on the battlefield. He wouldn't sit at a lamplit desk in the company office drawing maps, after all. He'd plot diagrams and escape routes for his battery in the midst of simulated warfare. The noisy room, the stale air, the shifting groups of young people converged into one sinking realization that this was only the first of many military moments when expectation would dissolve in the face of baffling reality.
The processing station was like a bargain basement in a department store. All this activity going on, and the same disappointment. Oh, look at that wonderful thing. Ah, they don't have it in my size. Or if it's in my size, somebody grabs it right out of my hand. You want to be a map maker? Don't we all? Here is the artillery.
By the time Jim stepped from the final cubicle, the last box on the last form checked, he'd been reduced to the most vital of statistics. Differentiated from all the others, he was distilled to the essential Private James Herbert Keenan that would be his identity for the next 3 years. It was easy enough to find one's way through a maze, he reassured himself. Hadn't he heard the secret once? The secret of always keeping the left hand against the labyrinth wall? No matter how many times one had to retrace one's steps, no matter how much backtracking was involved, the method would always eventually lead to the way out. He wondered if the theory was true, and he wondered at the map he could devise that would include such touch points all the way to the exit. That night, he had only to venture as far as the hotel across the street from the MEPS building. He lay awake and thought of the countless boys who'd spent sleepless nights on this thin mattress, wondered where they'd gone when they'd left Detroit, what their lives might be like now. Morning light filled the drab room, and he rose to dress for his flight to Oklahoma and Fort Sill. Jim stepped into his barracks, his shirt collar already damp, though it was barely noon. The room provided little relief from the heat and humidity that had plagued the area for days. The parched fields surrounding Fort Sill were broken by scattered groves of trees, their leaves drooping, and the gentle hills far in the distance shimmered in the heat. 64 identical beds lined the concrete bay, beds separated by back-to-back metal lockers at their heads, offering only the slightest degree of privacy. Jim fit his black trunk into the bottom of his locker, changed into a fresh shirt, and made his way to the reception hall to report for his first Fort Sill assignment. Fort Sill had been built during the Indian Wars as a stronghold to subvert tribal raids into neighboring states. Now it was the training ground for Army field artillery soldiers and Marines, the preparedness center that Jim would call home for nearly 5 months. He didn't know it yet, but the fort had also been, for a time, home to his literary hero, Geronimo. In 1894, the Indian leader had been captured along with 341 other Chiricahua Apache prisoners of war and had lived in a village on the post until his death in 1909. One end of Jim's bay opened into the day room, a sunny space furnished with tables and chairs and plastic M16s lined along one wall, one for each of the soldiers. In one corner of the day room stood a television for the enjoyment of the sergeants venturing from their offices on the floor below. A pleasant room, inviting, and a room the trainees must not enter without permission. Jim understood the reason for such rules. The television was off limits for the same reason his Adamant logo t-shirt and his long hair were forbidden. He understood and appreciated that when he'd entered the military, he'd put on a uniform, and with it a persona, that until the day of discharge he would never entirely put off. He understood the need for the soldier to relinquish his individuality, to sacrifice personal desires, not through mindless conformity, but a dedication to the one overriding goal, to be ready at a second's notice to move and act with his battalion as one cohesive being. He understood, but he bristled. His days began at 0400 hours with a regimen of push-ups and sit-ups and pull-ups and runs. Under the demanding Staff Sergeant Lawrence Brew, he learned of triage and CPR and the use of tourniquets on the battlefield. Brew stood over him while he took apart his M16 and tried his best to maintain his focus while he reassembled it. "Just as you're getting good at this," he would explain, "they come up and start yelling at you. It's not about speed. It's about putting it together under stress." Brew shouted his orders, and Jim and his battalion marched and turned again at his command, until they learned to move as one across the training field, not a footstep out of place, not an arm out of sync. In the afternoon, they loaded their backpacks and set out on 10-mile marches to the edges of the compound. Exhausted and thirsty, they pitched their tents, longing for rests under the canvas shade. Invariably, a smoke grenade lobbed from some unseen position would interrupt their work, and they'd drop their ropes and bedrolls to defend their position, having received little training in exactly how such a thing was to be done. By 2000 hours, after eating dinner at record speed in the mess hall, they were back in their bunks, only to wake in the morning to repeat the grueling routine. More than 2 weeks after arriving at Fort Sill, Jim at last had a short respite, a few hours he was allowed to call his own. He lay on his bunk and tried to ignore the 100-degree heat, the cicadas buzzing incessantly in the trees outside, and wrote a letter to Kurt. He was honest with his friend about his unhappiness and vague sense of depression, but in true Jim fashion, he sprinkled the letter with his signature humor. Along one side of the page, he drew a stick figure character who demonstrated the two swift motions required in digging a hole and tossing the soil over one's shoulder, a job Jim had done every morning that week. Then his character morphed into a two-step diagram of the choreography involved in performing Devo's Jerkin' Back and Forth, a dance he and Kurt had not so long ago perfected at Johnny's.
August 19, 1982. Hello, Curtis Jensen, sis. Things have been jerking right along here. I don't really like it, but what can I do about it? I'm going crazy with no music and haven't had a do in Snickers for ages, or so it seems. I miss Johnny's a whole bunch. The beds suck, as do the uniforms. Basically, I don't like it, but I'm not really sure yet. I must give it a chance. I miss the beach with all my heart and tan. Only 3 more years and I'll be home for good, but until then, I'm counting the days. Be good. James H.K.
The summer of chocolate bars on the beach and late-night dance marathons at Johnny's had left Jim in less than prime physical condition. Nevertheless, he approached the 2-mile foot race with the same confidence he'd brought to every cross-country and track event, determined to give it his all. Held during the first weeks of basic training, the race was yet another test of enlistees' abilities, one more way to ascertain the individual training they might require. They changed into running shoes, the commotion and voices and Sergeant Brew's orders echoing from tile and metal, amplified across the indoor course. Jim ran, the sound of footsteps hard at his heels. No matter how great the surge of energy he summoned, no matter how intently he concentrated, he could not outdistance the sound. His own speed whistling in his ears, he evoked every pointer Coach Bishop had suggested freshman year, determined to stay ahead of whatever it was that pursued him. At the finish, he looked back. Far behind him, the nearest runner sprinted breathlessly. The steps he'd heard had been his own. Geronimo, Jim had learned, had at least once tried to escape Fort Sill and run through the night toward his home in Arizona, only to be captured the next morning and brought back to the prison. As much as Jim dreamed of freedom, he'd meant what he'd written to Kurt. He'd give Army life an honest chance, knowing the discipline and the skills he'd learned there would only serve him well, knowing a full term of service would mean tuition and art school. I was surprised that he joined the military. I always thought of him as a free spirit, choir director Ann Johnson would reflect years later. I didn't know if he would tolerate the imposed discipline, but his choice was a reflection of his incredible focus. Jim had a plan. So long as he held fast to that plan, the rigors of Fort Sill would be tolerable. He took advantage of the moments, however brief, that sustained his sense of self. The men he befriended were the gifted but underestimated boys of working-class backgrounds similar to his own, the few who shared his taste in music and a refusal to completely abandon their more unorthodox qualities. On the nights when he wasn't assigned fire duty and could sleep undisturbed, Jim pulled his pillow over his head, lowered the volume of his Walkman, and listened until he fell asleep to the Sex Pistols, the Plasmatics, the Pretenders, and Judas Priest's latest release he'd found at the PX. His exemplary performance in basic training qualified him for yet another test, a lengthy evaluation that seemed to him unfocused and pointless. He handed the completed exam to his superior and watched it disappear into the mysterious ether that he'd learned by then was the military. And on commencement day, he discovered that his performance and test scores had also qualified him to be named the battery's distinguished basic training graduate. His cumulative scores and rankings were the highest in the group, and his speed in the foot race had broken every record in platoon history. The countdown he'd begun in August had, if not reached an end, grown noticeably shorter. Private E2 Keenan packed his cassettes and his Walkman, eager for a brief holiday leave in Scottville, more than ready to depart Fort Sill, its battered fields, its groves of oak and hickory, the cramped bay, the stone pyramid in the Apache Indian Cemetery that marked Geronimo's grave. Snow fell upon the flat Kansas plains and the rows of buildings, their uninspired architecture repeating itself endlessly across the Fort Riley complex. It was home to more than 10,000 soldiers and their families, its barracks and schools and medical facilities extending across the fields. The fields, Jim knew, would be the setting of maneuvers and marches and mock battles. He crossed the yard and climbed the stairs to the second floor and his room, a stately space compared with the bay at Fort Sill. Three bunks stood against one wall, separated from the sitting area by a divider down the room's center. One of the bunks, Jim discovered, was assigned to Jeff Parks, a Fort Sill buddy and an avid Michael Jackson fan, his presence a welcome continuity. The three roommates pooled their pay for a small television and placed it beside a portable stereo on the table beneath the window. Their battered metal lockers were subject to inspection at a moment's notice, but their private bathroom was a luxury after the pandemonium of a communal latrine. Frequently, Jim was assigned fire guard duty, or to keep watch over tractors and heavy equipment parked in the lot across the street from the barracks. More often, he and his battalion were dispatched to field exercise, bivouacking on the grounds and engaging in protracted and realistic battle. He packed the essentials he'd need during the long day and night, his compass and levels and coils of measuring rope, and more important, the sterno kit to make more palatable the cans of beans and franks, the mysterious corn hash, and the paste-like chicken concoction that no amount of heat or salt and pepper could improve. He packed, too, the envelopes of laxative preparation necessary to counteract the fiber-free and binding sea rations. At night, he lay in his bedroll on the hard Kansas ground, dreaming of the ice cream parlor back home and of the butter pecan and black cherry he'd enjoyed as if it would last forever. Advanced individual training was no game in a sunny Ravenna meadow where the game was interrupted when the sun went down. It was a month-long combat enactment, a day-and-night simulation of war.
No one was pushing the idea that an actual war was a possibility, but it became immediately apparent to me that we were doing desert training. We weren't that far out of Vietnam, and it seemed to me we pretty much screwed the pooch over there. So what are we doing? Did we have our asses handed to us in the marshlands? Shouldn't we be doing wetland training so that doesn't happen again? We were being prepared for desert warfare. Something was already up in 1983, but nobody tells you things like that.
Ahead of the tank batteries, the 82 Charlie team crossed the rutted field in their weathered Jeep, stopping to set up sextants and tripods and to install hubs alerting the batteries of their location and targets. The artillery squad fired a second round into a barrage of rifle shots, then retreated into the turmoil of smoke and shouts and black boots trampling the brown grass. Dummy rounds and smoke grenades bursting on all sides, Jim and the other surveyors darted laterally among the troops, determining their coordinates and the likely locations of the enemy, the classroom geometry and algebra at last beginning to make sense. Dusty and weary, Jim envisioned another 2.5 years of charting stars and treetops, 30 more months of unquestioning obedience, of every trimmed hair in place and boots polished to an acceptable shine, of donning the costume of good soldier and perfecting his performance in the tragedy of imitation warfare. 2.5 years, an eternity before he'd spread across his desk a sheet of clean white drafting paper, his collection of pencils and drawing pens in a squat jar just within reach. Despite its rigors, Fort Riley offered a freedom unimagined in Oklahoma. On Saturdays, Parks took his car from the adjoining lot and drove Jim to the Colonial in nearby Junction City, where they saw National Lampoon's Vacation and Trading Places. The more lax barracks rules allowed Jim to add personal touches to his room, a hot air popcorn maker and an electric kettle in which he boiled water for soup and Earl Grey to enjoy from his own mug. On the days they didn't go to the field, the battalion gathered for lunch in the mess hall, and then were allowed a few minutes in their rooms before beginning their afternoon duties. Jim and his roommates tuned their television to The Young and the Restless, propped the door open with a boot, and kept an ear cocked for the sergeant's call to formation. When they were summoned, they fell in and received their orders for later in the day. As soon as they were dismissed, they darted upstairs to continue their escape into the world of ill-timed pregnancies, returns of long-lost relatives, sudden amnesia, and the appearance of evil twins. The drama and emotion-torn relationships reminded Jim, however unrealistically, of the civilian world he'd left behind. "I didn't give a fuck about that show," he would later recall. "I couldn't tell you what it was about. All I know is that it was all we had." And at bedtime, he triple-stacked Pink Floyd or REM on the stereo and fell asleep to A-side songs one night and B the next. Late that spring, a letter arrived with the results of the test Jim had taken months before. Of the thousands of enlistees who'd completed the exam, Jim was among the few whose scores qualified them to attend West Point's preparatory school, the first step toward admittance to the military academy. He didn't weigh his options or seek advice. Before he reached the end of the letter, he'd made his decision. Prep school would be the end of muddy fields, of tins of pale roast beef, of the isolation of Fort Riley life. He imagined classrooms and libraries, discussions over coffee with students as bright as and brighter than he, music and art and knowledge beyond firearm assembly and transit lines, and the leisure to discover them. Nearly a month of accumulated leave meant PFC Keenan could pay an extended visit home before he must report to New Jersey as a cadet candidate. It meant a July amid acres of sweet corn and string beans and the flowers in Mike's elaborate gardens, refreshing displays after the brown, parched expanse of Oklahoma and Kansas. On Kurt's days off from the grocery store, the pair returned to their spot at the lake, the cooling breezes a reprieve from the 90-degree heat, the tubs of Blue Moon and Rocky Road at the ice cream parlor, indeed inexhaustible. The two found they'd outgrown the adolescent dramas of Johnny's and spent afternoons walking the trails at the state park and splashing in the shallow end of the lake there, speculating about what the future might hold. And in the evenings, Jim discovered the local girls a year older, too, a year more mature, and ready to explore with him new levels of intimacy. Jim downplayed his prep school offer and shared his plan with only Mike and Jan. Remote and provincial as the county seemed to him now, he believed few there would appreciate the magnitude of his achievement. He felt he owed them no explanation, and instead quietly focused his sights on the design he'd put in place the year before. Jim soon discovered that prep school, though it meant the end of sea rations and night patrols, wasn't without its difficulties. Shortly after arriving at Fort Monmouth, he reported in to Kurt. "Am I sore all over or what?" he wrote. "I am totally tired from intense push-ups and pull-ups. Our hours are 5:30 to 10 p.m. The food is okay if you get the time to taste it. They rush us so fast through the mess hall. There are girls everywhere, but the look-but-don't-touch rule is not in effect. You can't even look." What would Devo do in a situation like this? The U.S. Military Academy Preparatory School was a complex of austere concrete buildings and parking areas, a stark, treeless tract belying New Jersey's designation as the Garden State. Jim was heartened to learn that his relative freedom there would allow visits to nearby Eatontown and the ocean only 5 miles distant. And, more tempting, a rail line at the western edge of the post offered connections that would take him all the way to Manhattan. His room was an improvement over the quarters at Fort Sill and Fort Riley, carpeted and furnished with stylish wooden lockers and bed frames. He shared the double room with a country music lover given to chewing tobacco and spitting the dregs into a coffee cup. It was all Jim could do to put up with his albums, and his roommate felt the same about Jim's, Motley Crue, and Sex Pistols. But in spite of their differences, the two found common ground in their mission to compete on the prep school wrestling team and their drive to succeed at the academy. Half the 360 men and women in Jim's class had entered USMAPS directly from high school. They were the exceptional athletes and team captains who required a taste of military life and an academic refresher before entering West Point as members of its lacrosse and cross-country and football teams. The others were basic training graduates like Jim, who would spend the next months in class, preparing for the rigors of military school. And after working their way through algebra and trigonometry, after memorizing endless vocabulary lists, after more push-ups and pull-ups and track meets and wrestling matches, after learning the fundamentals of military science, only half would receive a West Point appointment. For most of the cadet candidates, West Point was their one channeled aspiration, and they lived and breathed the USMAPS motto, desire, faith, effort. They'd been winnowed from thousands of hopefuls and now jockeyed for one of the coveted 180 appointments. In their zeal, they exercised sometimes underhanded tactics to protect their own place in the hierarchy of contenders. They kept an ear trained on idle conversation, the innocent speculations about the wisdom of attending West Point, and might report to their higher-ups as little as an innocuous remark spoken over coffee.
Even in idle conversations, you had to be careful what you said, because anything you said might be construed as a lie and make it easier for others to get in. As a creative person, I had to be very careful how I talked. It wasn't so much the administration watching you. Your best friend was your worst enemy. The cadet honor code said we wouldn't lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. Tolerate is the part that gives everybody license to kick out their roommate.
Jim was careful to keep his true plans to himself, but his frustration with the blind loyalty and the snitching was clear in his letters to Kurt. If I'm not discovered soon by EMI records and get taken away from this stuff to become a rock star, he wrote, I think I'm going to have to become a famous war hero. Jim dedicated himself to USMAP's cross-country, track, and wrestling with the same focus he had in high school. His contribution, he knew, would bring the Black Knights to victory in meets with other East Coast institutions and their arch-rival, the Naval Academy Prep School. He sprinted with the cross-country team in distance training runs along Ashbury Park's beach and boardwalk, Coach Beal running alongside them. Jim and his teammates grew to expect Beal's shouts that opened each practice. Gentlemen, double knots! A reminder to discourage them from pausing to retie their shoelaces mid-run. Beal possessed the self-assurance and natural grace of his East Coast heritage. Both USMAP's dean and cross-country coach, Beal required every action in the classroom and on the course be completed with alacrity and dispatch. Beloved, despite his gruff manner and exacting expectations, the practical and unbiased Beal was ever willing to support the lonely, the discouraged, the CC in need of an ally. Often, he invited Jim and a few fortunate others to join him in conversation and challenging Socratic dialogue. He prefaced each session with the same request. Allow me to pontificate just for a moment, if you will, gentlemen. His rhetorical exchanges challenged the CCs to think beyond the obvious, and when they failed to uphold their end of an argument, he sternly accused them of suffering from diarrhea of the mouth or constipation of the brain.
He would go into a conversation, and he would soon realize that he was explaining to everybody that they had their heads up their asses and they needed to figure out how to pull them out. He didn't care about your political or social background as long as you were focused on how you could be better. He said he'd help people to a point, but if they weren't helping themselves, it meant nothing. He'd go, I have 10% for everybody. You need to do the other 90.
Jim stood at inspection, his slim, athletic figure showing off the cut of his dress greens to perfection. Every seam was knife blade sharp, his cuffs fell just so over his insteps, and the brass buttons down the front of his jacket shone. He looked the methodical military man living exactly the life he wished to live. Even as he presented the outward image of a compliant and proper CC, he managed to maintain a degree of personal integrity. On his shirt front, hidden beneath his black necktie, he attached 3 safety pins and an earring made from a razor blade.
The one time anybody found out about anything like that, they just laughed. They didn't want to bring it up because they didn't want to champion it. We'd gone to West Point to watch Army play Notre Dame. When we got there, I realized I'd forgotten my tie and my white shirt. The plebes I was rooming with didn't have anything I could borrow. They have a whole different set of uniforms. I went, does anybody have safety pins? Somebody had a pair of scissors, so I cut the elastic waistband out of my sweatpants and safety pinned my black socks to it so they went around my neck. Under my dress greens, I'm wearing my YB normal shirt, and if anybody made me open my jacket, there would be this foot going to the right across my tit.
Jim worked as hard as the others to become the model soldier, but he already considered himself an artist. And with the artist's instinctive need to rearrange life's tidy boundaries, he grew impatient with the cosseted life of comfortable bus rides to cross-country invitationals and the warm, carpeted room at the end of the day. The others unquestioningly accepted their protected existence, an existence uncomplicated by the messy disorder of half-learned guitar riffs, in-progress poems, and paint-splattered studio floors. He chose extracurricular activities that allowed him to create and to sing, attending at least one editorial meeting of a student newspaper, The Night Crier, and caroling in Eatontown with the Glee Club at Christmas time. Jim took his turn at all-night charge of quarters duty, fielding phone calls and announcing the next day's shifts, taking advantage of the quiet and the office typewriter to work on poems and letters to Kurt. He'd been away long enough to regard Scottville as isolated and behind the times, a place where an evening's entertainment might at best include creeping about a moonlit field engaging in the time-honored rural fun of cow tipping. As you know, cows sleep standing up, he wrote. What you can do is push the fucker over and run, because when he hits, he's going to wake up and chase. More fun. Life, he reminded his friend, was meant to be experienced firsthand rather than observed from within the boundaries of a quiet Midwestern town. The escalator climbed from the Penn Station concourse and delivered Jim and his Fort Monmouth buddies into the bustle and chill of Midtown. They wandered the crowded avenues among purposeful secretaries and street sweepers and dancers hurrying off to auditions. They dodged bold bicycle couriers and black-clad punksters in spiky leather wristbands and carts high-piled with nude mannequins. They started at the shrill whistles of doormen beneath awnings of fine hotels and stepped into clouds of cologne escaping the revolving doors of Macy's and paused to examine new cassettes in record shops. They roamed Times Square, its theater lobbies bright behind tall glass doors. At last, they turned onto 6th Avenue, where the deco and neon of Radio City Music Hall rose against the darkening sky, the block-long marquee announcing the evening's performance. Kiss fans, eager to experience the band's New York stop on its Lick It Up tour, snaked around the corner and partway down 50th Street. Jim and his friends took their places at the end of the line, tickets firmly in hand, their toes tingling. They stamped their black boots against the cold, watched the impatient crowd, watched yellow cabs pull up at the curb, watched as Gene Simmons, Paul Stanley, and the rest of the KISS entourage pushed past them toward the entrance, close enough to recognize, close enough almost to touch. Jim returned to Fort Monmouth, eager to share his adventure with Sarah. She would appreciate the thrill of standing among thousands, swaying to Young and Wasted and Detroit Rock City, his own heartbeat in time with the rhythms. As best he could, he'd tell her of his sudden sense of pitched weightlessness, as if his every choice, however small, had led inexorably to this swirl of colored spotlight and costume and story, this warm theater and the snow falling gently over the city. Sarah Laguno was the sole woman on the USMAP's postseason cross-country team. Jim was one of the 10 men who'd qualified for the team, and they'd discovered in the sport their common bond. They ran side by side during training runs at Asbury Park, each understanding with a glance the other's unspoken jokes, and straining to glimpse the ocean behind the rows of garish hot dog stands and clamorous pinball arcades that lined the boardwalk. Before long, Sarah and Jim were constant companions, discussing over tea the movies they saw together in Eatontown and the music they loved. On Saturday afternoons, they walked to nearby Monmouth Mall to flip through the bins of Psychedelic Furs and The Pretenders, albums brand new to Sarah. "Jim had such a sense for music," she would recall. "If he thought a new release was good, you could almost assume that band was going to make it." The two looked as if they belonged together. Sarah, slim and petite, and Jim, toned and fit, and more resembling his high school illustrations of the small, wiry character he'd called Maynard. They spoke of marriage, albeit knowing neither was ready for such a commitment. Jim referred to Sarah in a letter to Kurt as his one and only, while Sarah struggled with the realization that she most probably was gay. Their intimacy, though, was deeper than sexual. Theirs was the non-threatening, respectful relationship Sarah required, and the foundation of a lifelong friendship. "Jim is the only man I've ever allowed to hold my hand," she would admit decades later. "He would change who he was for no one," she recalled, and he instinctively extended to her the same expectation of integrity. Early that spring, in another of the military's unexplained reorganizational maneuvers, the CCs were allowed to select new roommates, and Jim requested of his section captain that he room with John. 6 feet tall, sensitive, and a skilled concert pianist, John struggled through his days at the prep school, his attendance there a fulfillment of his parents' wish that he become a soldier. Jim had heard his flawless performance at the piano, and seen the lengths to which John went to be accepted among the more aggressive CCs. He'd watched him return from evenings with his tormentors, seen him subject his previous roommate to inebriated stupors and their messy aftermaths. "I was like, Jesus, dude," he would recall. "This must be breaking your heart."
John was clearly unhappy, in prep school only to please his parents and going along with what others forced him to do. They'd pour all the shit in a glass and spit in it and dare him to drink it. And then he'd completely puke all over his blankets and bed. Makes me wretch thinking about the shit they did to him. He would come in drunk, and I would go fucking drill sergeant all over his ass, laying to him and go, "You don't need to fucking listen to these assholes." Just trying to push and push and push him to what he really wanted to do, which was play piano. It burned me up to see that he could do something better than most people, and yet he wasn't doing it. I couldn't sit back and watch this happen. I told him, "You're your own person. You don't need to behave this way. You're loved, you're talented. You don't need to do these things to impress these knuckleheads." But he was smart, and he did all the testing properly, and he ended up getting his appointment to West Point and came out as a private. Of course, there's a punchline. John couldn't take the pressure and later committed suicide. Who knows? He may have gone down that path anyway, even if he'd become a pianist. But at the time, I knew something was wrong, that he wasn't supposed to be there.
When Jim saw someone who wasn't following their heart and was choosing the wrong path, He tried to bring out what they should be focusing on, Sarah recalled. He was always impatient with people who just followed the crowd. He had a name for people like that. He called them tools. Good news plus bad news. I need a good tan, and I've got the ultimate solution to get one, Jim wrote Kurt in early May. I received my appointment to West Point last week and turned in my declination of appointment card. I've been restationed at Fort Microwave of Armpits, Hood, Texas. Hence the awesome tan. The decision had not been an easy one. Jim had enjoyed his success at prep school and had forged comfortable relationships with the like-minded Sarah and Dean Beale. Accepting the appointment was tempting, yet he felt he'd come too far to relinquish the dream of art school. As his grades continued to improve, and his skills on the mat and track brought him recognition, Jim had begun to suspect that his achievements might just qualify him for the appointment. And if he accepted, his fate would be sealed. He'd be groomed for a military career as an officer, and he knew that if he were to make such a commitment, he'd take it seriously and see it through to the end without a backward glance at the tuition fund he must forfeit. He could think of no one to ask for unbiased advice. Even Sarah, her own direction clear, hadn't known him long enough to truly understand the doubts and certainties he held in equal measure. Mike, convinced of Jim's eventual acceptance, had proudly announced it to his fellow teachers months before. The people of Scottville equated West Point with achievement and prestige, and Jim knew that if he turned down the appointment, he must suffer the dismay they'd feel as deeply as if his decision represented some failure of their own.
At that moment, all these voices are ringing in your head, telling you what you're supposed to do. I knew I'd hear the wind go out of my father if I turned this thing down. And I heard Newkirk pounding his shoes on the desk, going, "Don't let anybody influence your decision. It's your life, it's your choice. Don't just jump on that cheerleader bandwagon."
And Jim knew, as he'd known for a long time, which was the right path. He moved his belongings across the courtyard to the washout section. The barracks where those dismissed for misconduct or failing grades were sequestered while they awaited their orders. His West Point slot was returned to the pool of willing candidates, and only weeks before the USMAP's Class of 84 graduation, Jim said goodbye to Sarah and departed for Texas to serve the final 15 months of his military commitment. 2 days in 90-degree heat had burned his skin to a redness no solar cane could relieve, had any been available in the field miles from the post. He scooped water from his steel helmet and splashed it across his face in a vain attempt to remove the thick film of dust. He could feel the grit caked deep in his nostrils and his ears, and he ran his fingers through his hair, an immobile mat of grime and sweat. "My hair feels like one of those horsehair doormats after Uncle Bob and the kids have wiped their muddy boots on it," he wrote Kurt. Field training at Fort Hood had begun only days after his arrival, with cavalry and fire brigades stationed about the massive installation, the all-too-familiar western landscape, otherwise barren, but for sparse stands of mountain laurel and red oak. His bay was a mirror image of his Kansas room, austere but comfortable enough. His roommate, Wayne, bright and personable, welcomed him, and he in turn extended his hand and introduced himself as Maynard. Early on his first morning at Fort Hood, Maynard came downstairs and crossed the lawn for formation in the parking lot at the front of the barracks. He stopped short, overcome by an unexpected vertigo. The asphalt, the vehicles along its periphery, the tall lampposts undulated in black waves, shiny in the sunshine. He blinked, regained his balance, and looked again. Crickets. Black crickets. Thousands of them, hatched in the relentless Texas heat and humidity, had settled across the lot, where they would remain all summer long. The wriggling landscape seemed the plague and pestilence Maynard had been warned about from the pulpits in Ohio. As he stood at attention amid the heaving blanket of chirping insects, he performed a quick calculation. In 440 days, his only concerns would be turning in a drawing assignment on time and sweeping spilled Cheerios from the floor of his own apartment. Many of those days he'd spend at the shack behind the barracks, inventorying the battalion's survey equipment, or in the motor pool, servicing its fleet of jeeps and gamma goats, six-wheeled semi-amphibious vehicles last driven through the jungles of Vietnam. He'd check oil levels in vehicles never moved from the lot and order replacement parts long obsolete, just as he'd ordered them the day before and the day before that, just as sweaty, dusty men before him had ordered them each day for the past 10 years. Every few weeks, the battalion marched with tents and equipment and a limited water supply to bivouac in the dry fields and take part in combat simulations at Fort Irwin. They sat upon the ground at mealtime and opened the foil and plastic MRE pouches, their ready-to-eat pork patties and stew, and diced turkey with gravy, no more appetizing than the sea rations they'd recently replaced. Maynard knew next to nothing about cars. He'd never found the need to complete driver's ed or earn his driver's license, able always to ride with friends into Ludington and run to and from school each day as part of his cross-country training. Even so, he was assigned the duty of taking the wheel of the Bronco and transporting the battalion's command sergeant major throughout the encampment. If he didn't quite understand gears and powertrain suspension, Jim consoled himself with the fact that he was upholding a family tradition by acting as chauffeur, just as Grandpa Gridley, a member of the 20th Armored Division, had when he'd driven his colonel behind German front lines during World War II. It passed the days. Walled by steep cliffs of the Tehachapi, San Gabriel, and San Bernardino Mountains, the Fort Irwin National Training Center was an ideal location for desert training, situated as it was at the southern edge of Death Valley. Only the occasional Joshua tree interrupted the flat, arid canyon, a canyon continually swept by hot, dry winds that kept the valley in the 80s even through the night. The Fort Hood group fought a losing battle on their opponent's home turf. The resident battalion was accustomed to the climate and the terrain, and Maynard watched buddies drop in the heat, overcome by endless darting among smoke bombs and dummy rounds in the 120-degree afternoons. Once they were back in Texas, he and Wayne tried to forget the punishing days in the desert. Maynard exhausted his pay at the record store at Killeen Mall, where he discovered Bauhaus and the Ramones and Romeo Void. He discovered, too, the nearby Irish pub and its happy hour club, a program he eagerly joined to help offset the doldrums of the otherwise temperate Bell County. One lonely Saturday, Wayne off on adventures of his own, Maynard sat at the bar and quickly downed his 2 tequila shots in a race against arriving late for the showing of Ghostbusters at the cinema next door. He entered the already darkened theater and slid into a seat in the front row. Craning backward, he found it almost impossible to focus, and in his distraction, the laughter behind him sounded oddly out of sync with the action taking place on the screen. He thought of crickets and of dust, of the music and shouts and taxi horns of Manhattan, of Lake Michigan, of the seat beside him where Sarah should be. Perspiration trickled from his armpits and down his sides, cold beneath his sweater. His salty fingers gleaming with butter and shards of popcorn kernels, he wiped sweat from his face, and his calculations muddled in his head. 300 days? 250? And before the autumn was over, he'd completed his art school application and walked it confidently to the Fort Hood mailroom. "From deep within the plum, I pull the pie," he wrote. He'd begun to approach his writing with a seriousness befitting an art student, Still unpolished, to be sure, the poems he wrote in his Fort Hood room reveal a maturing sensibility, an adept use of metaphor and inverted language, a lyricist's talent for conflating the visual and the oral to create a provocative synesthesia. No doubt as much to convince himself as his readers, he took as his theme his bold belief that dire straits might be transformed to triumph with only a shift in perspective.
Eye of the Needle. Waking from a bed of nails, I slowly lift my tattered sails against the cruel and cutting winter winds. I march the world in seconds flat and use the ball to hit the bat. I'm free of rights, moralities, and sins. Drawing pictures you can hear, I squeeze a river from a tear and move a mountain breathlessly at will. I stroll atop the estuary in a world so sanguinary, loving not the death but just the kill. Holding whispers in my palm, I bring the troubled waters calm. From deep within the plum, I pull the pie. I make the fox run from the rabbit. Impossibility my habit, passing in and through the needle's eye.
By January, he was traveling often to Austin, 60 miles distant, attending Black Flag's Loose Nut Tour concert there, and dancing at the city's new wave mecca, Club Iguana, with Cheryl Carney, a nurse in Fort Hood's medical division. He found in Cheryl a perfect companion. She with her spiked, bleached hair, and he in neck chains crafted from razor blades and padlocks, both of them in dark eyeliner that matched their black spandex and fingerless gloves. "Cheryl taught me how to be yourself while you're also being somebody else," Maynard recalled in a 2012 interview. Living off-post with her husband and concealing her lesbianism from the military community, Cheryl had discovered ways to wear the mask within her mask and yet never sacrifice the integrity of either role. She was able to put on her Clark Kent at work and then turn into Superman when the music started, Maynard said. He grew his hair as long as he dared, keeping its sides neatly trimmed and tucking the wavy top beneath his cap. But on club nights, he tousled his curls and pulled them down across his forehead, one bleached strand extended over one eyebrow. He bleached tiger stripes down one leg of his tight jeans, tied a colorful scarf around each ankle, wrapped his waist in studded belts. A package of strawberry Twizzlers open on the bar beside his 7-7, he practiced the aloof attitude required of the serious punk, secretly pleased that this could be his way of life in 200 days and counting. And on August 4th, the countdown reached its end. Sunshine flickered through Maynard's window as the plane banked gently in its descent over Grand Rapids. Below were green fields and forests, lakes and winding rivers, and somewhere in the distance, the campus of the Kendall School of Design. Just inside the arrival gate, he spotted Kurt standing near the newspaper kiosk and raced to tell him what their first stop must be. They loaded the oversized black footlocker into the trunk of Kurt's father's Buick and made their way along Patterson Avenue and 28th Street to Woodland Mall and the JCPenney Hair Salon. Still in his dress greens, SP4 Keenan placed his Penny's credit card on the receptionist's desk and politely asked a stylist to shave his hair into a mohawk.